from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, how a disturbing babysitter got a local romance novelist into writing, and how Dan Hicks really feels about his most famous song, How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away? But first, a temporary town is springing up in the Nevada desert to house next week's Burning Man Festival. It's an annual celebration of living and expressing yourself freely in the company of thousands of people. The festival takes its name from the ritual burning of a huge effigy of a man. Burning Man happens in Black Rock Desert in northwestern Nevada. It starts on Monday. Joining us to tell us what it's like are three people who've been to Burning Man many times. We'll start with David Watts Barton, occasional host of Insight, blogger, former music writer at the Sacramento Bee, and he's going to Burning Man very soon. David, welcome back to Insight.
Glad to be here.
How often have you been?
This will be my ninth year.
My goodness, so you must get a lot out of it.
I love it. It's Halloween, Thanksgiving, and New Year's Eve all wrapped into one.
Okay, what was it that sent you there in the first place?
I'd heard about it for years, and I, like a lot of people, was intimidated by the prospect of going and having to be self-supporting in a very, very harsh environment. And I actually have found out since then it is even harsher than I thought it was, and yet you can still survive quite nicely and not only survive but thrive.
How do you mean it's even harsher than you thought? Because we're talking about a desert in northwestern Nevada.
Yeah, but I've been to the desert. I've been to Death Valley. I've been to different high deserts around Nevada and eastern California and Sahara and different places. And this is really extreme. There isn't a rock there. It's just a completely flat plain. It's a lake bed. And so there are no bushes. There's no scrub. There's no wildlife to speak of. It's just completely barren, and you get what you bring to it and what other people bring to it.
And there's so much going on at Burning Man. I'm wondering, was this one thing in particular that drew you in the first place?
I had a friend who was going, and that sort of emboldened me a little bit. And I actually was going to go with a friend, and then that fell through at the last minute in 1999, so I didn't go until the next year. But he brought back some videos, and I watched them. I was like, yeah, I'm going to go next year.
Do you play any role there, or do you just show up and take it all in? Because there are lots of people who do things, you know, barter and perform, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not bartering, which we could talk about later.
Sorry, but that's right. I was looking for the right word and got the wrong one.
It's gifting, yeah.
Gifting.
But, I do a lot of costumes and entertaining in different ways, playing music and things like that. But there's Burning Man has a raft of mottos, leave no trace, and things like that. One of them is no spectators. And that means everybody's meant to come and do what you do.
You're meant to contribute, not just take.
Yeah. And on the premise that it's better to give than to receive. And if everybody comes and does something, it's going to be really something. And it is.
We're talking with three people who have gone to Burning Man many times. We'll be going again this year. That's David Watts Barton. Also with us is Kent Deberg from the Pancake Playhouse. It's a Burning Man theme camp that served thousands of hot pancakes to thousands of hot burners, in other words, people at Burning Man, since 2001. Kent, welcome to Insight.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Did you go to Burning Man before you got involved with Pancake Playhouse?
No, I camped with them the first time I ever camped in 2002.
And what drew you there? Was it because of Pancake Playhouse?
Pancake Playhouse is a group of friends, and I had a crush on one of the people. So, and we're still together. Burning Man is our anniversary.
Oh, I see. So that worked out.
Yes.
Tell us what happens at Pancake Playhouse. Obviously, you're serving pancakes.
Every morning, we serve pancakes and play soft rock, Michael Jackson, and other non-electronic music for people to just chill out and enjoy some good food.
What kind of pancakes do you serve?
Plain old regular bought at a big box store pancakes. So they're very simple. This maple syrup is what makes them really spectacular. And sometimes we'll get creative and put chocolate chips or blueberries in them, or people will bring us things that we will then put in the pancakes. But the best part of it all is the joy that we bring to people. People are so grateful to get pancakes. The looks on their faces when they're so hot and so hungry, and they are looking for a place to go, and we give them shade and good chill music, and they love it.
The Pancake Playhouse recipes on the website, pancakeplayhouse.org. It's pretty simple, just unspecified amount of water. I like that one. How do you pay for all this, since you don't sell the pancakes?
Well, we gather money all year round. the people that camp there pay dues, and a lot of it is stuff that we contribute to the camp. And then we also host fundraisers. I've had beer pong tournaments, bowling tournaments, a chili cook-off, a Bloody Mary mix-off, dinner parties, anything we can charge people for.
What do you get out of it? Because why? I mean, people usually charge money for their time and their expertise and for the cost of things that they buy that they're giving to other people, especially when it's people you don't know. What do you get out of it that justifies all this expenditure?
We get a lot of joy, a lot of joy. Every person that we make happy makes us doubly happy that they enjoyed what we gave them. It's just the love of giving. And you find that so much at Burning Man. You love to give even more than to receive, me personally. Just the looks on people's faces, again, is so amazing. And it makes it all worthwhile.
That's Kat Deberg from the Pancake Playhouse, who's been going to Burning Man since 2002.
Yeah.
And our third guest in our studio is photographer Andy Pishalnikov, who's been photographing Burning Man since 2005. Andy, welcome.
Thank you.
Had you gone to Burning Man before 2005 when you were not taking photographs?
No. I had always wanted to, but I had not gone.
Oh, I see. What stopped you going?
Actually, there was another friend of mine that was an accomplished artist. I used to do makeup effects, and so did he. And we came up with a plan to create an installation of swimming skeletons in the desert. And we actually did a prototype piece. And he had a motorhome. And I thought we both thought we wouldn't survive in the desert without a motorhome. So when the motorhome broke down before the trip, we canceled. And this was in mid-1990s. And the tickets were horribly expensive for us, but we didn't go. So I had always wanted to go. And I waited until I knew other friends that were going.
You said the tickets were horribly expensive, and you're a guy who has a regular day job. How much are we talking about?
Well, for me, I didn't have that great of a job back then, and I think it was somewhere close to $100. And at the time, with what my earnings were, it was a lot of money.
And that got you into Burning Man for a week?
Yes. Okay. Prices have changed a bit today.
David, you've been going for quite some time. Yeah. Has it gotten much more expensive in recent years?
It's gone up every year. And that's a bit of a bone of contention with some people about where's all this money going. But a lot of it goes to the artists. What they do is they've created a Black Rock Arts Foundation, and they give honoraria to different artists to build these. Because some of these art projects cost tens of thousands of dollars to put up. This isn't small potatoes. It's really big stuff.
I understand, but then and you can't speak for the festival, of course, but you might have an idea. How do they draw the line between someone like Kat, who gives her time and contributes materials for the benefit of the festival, and others who don't and who get an honorarium?
It has to be an art project that is proposed as Andy was talking about, where you have to show drawings and some kind of a track record, I would think. Because some of these things that people build, I mean, they're safety factors. The big art project last year was called Crude Awakening. It was a 90-foot-tall wooden oil derrick that, after the burn, blew up using tens of thousands of gallons of jet fuel and created this huge mushroom cloud. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. But it took a lot of people working on that to make it happen.
I think we have a photograph of said event on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. If you go there, we have 9 photographs that were taken by our guest, Andy Pishalnikov. And this one, it's near the bottom and it looks like a sort of yellow-orange mushroom cloud. It's called Crude Mushroom. Andy, is that what we're looking at, this event that David was talking about?
Yes, that's within the first second of the ignition of 4 large propane tanks and the mixture of jet fuel. It went very fast up, and if you look in the picture, you'll see a tiny white dot. That's the moon.
Yes.
This was shot with an extreme wide angle. It was a very, very large cloud.
Now, I'm guessing the carbon footprint of this exhibit was pretty extensive. Was this controversial?
It was somewhat. Particularly last year, the theme was the Green Man, and so it was an environmental theme, and so there was a lot about recycling and all kinds of really interesting projects. And some people objected to Crude Awakening because it was this huge waste of fuel. But what I thought when I saw it, and I read, I think beforehand, that they said that the amount of energy that was expended in blowing this thing up was equal to what San Francisco goes through in 1 minute. And so I thought, well, okay, so that's one minute worth with in San Francisco to get this spectacular explosion that was really, really did feel like a work of art to me. I thought it was amazing. And it was also fuel that was, I heard, that was jet fuel that was somehow compromised and they weren't going to be able to use it. And so they were going to destroy it anyway. So not necessarily sending up a huge cloud of black smoke in the middle of the Nevada desert, but still.
We're talking about Burning Man. It starts next Monday in northwestern Nevada in the desert. My guests are three people who've gone many times, David Watts Barton, Kat Deberg from the Pancake Playhouse, and photographer Andy Pishalnikov. Kat, how much of your day do you spend working at and hanging out at the Pancake Playhouse, and how much time do you have to hang out elsewhere at Burning Man?
Well, it's difficult to keep track of time while you're there, but pretty much pancakes takes up the whole morning, setting up, serving the pancakes, then washing all the dishes. And then we pass out in the afternoon. It's so hot and we've just, you know, put out a lot of effort for the pancakes. And then we go out at night. And at night is when we really have fun.
Meaning what?
Meaning riding the bike and going to the different, there's lots of dance camps. You can go to dance and listen to electronic music. Or my favorite last year was a place called the Paddy Mirage that was a giant Irish pub in the middle of the desert made out of wood. It had two stories and live music and Guinness.
Do people stay up all night?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. A lot of the people who eat our pancakes are people who have been up all night and need a place to sit down.
Because the sunset and the sunrises are the most beautiful time.
Yes.
There. Now, despite the attempt to create a sort of alternative community at Burning Man, there are certain government regulations need mm-hmm. to be complied with, including health permits, I guess. Yes.
We
for
get
the food.
We get a health permit every year, and they inspect us. For the first couple of years...
Do they come to the camp when underway?
Absolutely. Many times during the week. And for the first couple of years, we faltered a little bit, but for the last few years, we've been getting 100% every time.
How do you mean you faltered?
Well, a health inspector caught me licking my fingers one time in the kitchen. I don't do that anymore.
Andy, we've got other photographs of yours at capradio.org/insight. One that really caught my attention is on the bottom right, and it's a strange-looking truck that is sort of a combination between a gigantic truck and a scorpion. What is it?
Well, actually, I want to back up just for a quick second. I have much better images on my website. This got cropped. And I have a better one that was part of my show this year. It's the Big Rig Jig by Mike Ross. And it is two big rigs connected that go up into the sky. And they're interconnected. So one below is leaning forward. It has a tube that connects to the other one above that is actually looking down and facing the other big rig. It was absolutely amazing. This gentleman created it with a large team. You could climb through that tube. You enter through the back and you can climb up to the other rig.
It's hard to believe it's real when you look at the photograph. Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what I said on the back of my postcard. When I was there, that's why I go. Everything is just so phenomenal.
How tall was it?
I don't know.
Yeah, I actually interviewed the artist, and I'm trying to remember. It's two actual oil trucks,
I guess there's a guy who's standing at the bottom at the foot of the truck, and if he's 6 feet tall, then the big rig jig is many times his height.
Yeah, it's a good 40, 45, 50 feet tall, probably.
Perhaps. Goodness.
I don't know.
Was it dangerous?
No, it felt very solid to
me.
I
climbed up
inside.
In some of it. Yeah, I climbed up a little ways, but there were people coming down at the same time, and it just didn't seem tenable, so I didn't go up.
I believe he's been awarded funding to do public art in the state of Washington.
Yeah, a lot of these artists do things other places, too. They get started at Burning Man. There's an artist named David Best who builds a temple every year out of scrap wood and has built these temples that are much bigger than that, even. Just these enormous, gorgeous temples that are modeled on Burmese and Thai temples. And he's done them. He did one in San Francisco that was built right in the middle of the Octavia Street area.
Last year, there was some controversy over a premature burning of the man. Did any of you see that, know what happened?
Yeah, we were riding our bike right up to the man when it happened. And it was during the lunar eclipse. So we were riding up to the man, and there was a covered up moon right above it. And all of a sudden, there was a little pop, and it started burning.
When is the man supposed to be burned?
Saturday night.
So that's like a couple of days before the end of
it. At the very beginning, it starts at midnight on Sunday. And so this happened at about midnight or a little after on Monday.
About 2 o'clock a.m.
2 o'clock, yeah.
And do we know who did it and why?
Oh, yeah, they caught him.
Paul Addis.
Do we know why? Was it to spoil the festival, or was it to enhance it, or what?
He sounded like a pretty chaotic character, just in general, and this wasn't the first time that he'd done something pretty extreme like that. And it was people get a little. I mean, it's about. It's a funny thing because One of the great things about Burning Man is it's an exercise in community, they say. And what you do is you find out that you have to, there are a lot of things that it takes to make a community work. And that Burning Man, some people go to Burning Man, they say, oh God, there's so many rules up here. And there really are a lot of rules, but you need a lot of rules in order to make it work when you have that many people out in that kind of a situation. And you can't, there's been an increasing problem every year with people stealing other people's art, people destroying other people's art, because they just like, anything goes. And so, but there are still rules even at Burning Man.
Is that so? It sounds like the some discussion, maybe even controversy over this, because it started out with a very countercultural spirit, presumably not about rules, but rules inevitably started coming into it. How do people feel about that, Kent?
How do people feel about the rules?
About the number of rules that appear to be inevitably part of Burning Man, which is. People think is about something other than that.
Well, given that there are about 48,000 people up there, I'm sure there's 48,000 different opinions. I certainly hear a lot of opinions about the health rules we have to follow and how other people get shut down from giving food because they don't have the appropriate permits. But like David said, it's really necessary in order for the event to continue going on. We need to make agreements to follow certain rules.
Mm-hmm. It's for a week. It's the fifth largest city in Nevada.
My goodness.
Mm-hmm. Our camp has 50 people in it. We're known as Celestial Bodies. We don't mind one bit. And our energy keeps growing. We just built our first art car. And that's kind of like the baby steps you take as a group. As you go, you gain more and more passion. And we've built a rather elaborate one for a starter art car.
And one of the reasons that there are a lot of rules is that this is on BLM land. It's an ancient lake bed. It's a very pristine environment. And one of the mottos is leave no trace. And there are very solid reasons for that. One of which is if we do leave a trace, the BLM won't let us use it again. And so they spend a couple of months afterwards cleaning this place up, and they use GPS coordinates, and they go by every square meter and make sure every bit is clean. And so when you're camping, it makes you realize it's a very environmentally aware event, because you realize on this blank surface, everything you do has an impact. If some fake fur or glitter or water falls on the ground, you're kind of responsible for that, and you need to make sure that you minimize your impact.
It's made me a lot more aware of my trash. When you create trash up there, it's yours, and you have to take it home.
Have any of you been there when everyone or just about everyone has gone and seen what the place looks like afterwards?
I have, and it's actually, I'm only by a day, but I've seen it when there are these city blocks and there are all these incredible things, and you're driving down the street and there are all these buildings and people and vehicles, and they all go away. And for the most part, there are some ruts in the surface, and there's some spots where somebody emptied their remaining water or something like that. But for the most part, I've been amazed, at how clean it is. But then I've also heard that people leave bikes, people leave sofas, people leave all kinds of things. So there's still quite a cleanup that needs to go on. I mean, it's a work in progress, and a lot of people, some people are more responsible than others.
Yes. Let's look at another one of Andy Pashalnikov's photographs. This is a person wearing a fairly elaborate costume. It's called Golden Demon Standing. And if you're looking at the thumbnail, it's a guy with red wings. Who is this?
He didn't give his real name, but I found out after taking the photographs that he had been seen in a movie called Borat, and I had a friend show me the frame. So he has worn this costume at other places, but it was the reason I went and
waited.
Did
you see Borat?
No, I didn't, a friend showed me the clip where he was in it.
Really?
He just, Borat, he just, yes, yes, he yes. just appeared in the clip. He was one of the people off to the side when Borat was walking in a street.
Oh, my goodness.
But what was interesting is it took me a while to get permission to take the picture, and a swarm of photographers came around. And the costume was just so elaborate. He's wearing contact lenses, false teeth, ears, gold paint, and chain and leather.
And next to that photograph, there's a guy with a bowler hat and a bandana around his mouth. Is this a dust storm that's going on or something?
That's a dust storm at Center Camp, and he just looked so steampunk, which is something my wife and I are into, that I wanted to take the picture.
Kat, you have a name that you go by on the playa. What is it?
Oh, latke. It's a potato pancake.
As in the potato pancake. Yeah. Is that something you make or enjoy?
Everyone at Pancake Playhouse has a pancake name. We've never made latke, but that's my name.
Does everyone go by a name on the playa?
A lot of people do. A lot of people don't.
Do you have one?
Yes, but I'd have to kill you if I told you.
What about you, Andy? Do you have a name?
Yes, I laugh so hard I spit out my drink through my nose when I was named it by one of our camp members.
You were named it?
Yes, that's how you get your name usually, is you're gifted with it. Mm-hmm. And I was gifted with Playa Ratzi.
Playa Ratzi.
Because I'm always getting up early in the morning and staying up all the time to take pictures.
David, tell us a little bit more about this, the compensation process, gifting as opposed to bartering. Hmm. What does that mean?
It means that people come with the intention to give and not to receive. And they bring things. People make really incredibly everything from, there are a lot of bars, there are a lot of restaurants, and people have, these incredibly elaborate setups. I know a guy in San Francisco, he hasn't gone for the last few years, but he was early on. He used to spend about $35,000 just to build this camp. And then he had other people that worked with him, but he was the money guy. He was a Google guy, and during the early 2000s, there was a lot of money going to Burning Man because a lot of the people were dot-commers. And so there was a lot of money, a lot of creativity going in. That's aside. The main thing is that you go up to give, and you give, and people will give you things just as a token, or and then they do it in really elaborate ways and really fun ways. Last year we were sitting in camp, and some of us were just sitting around, and these guys came up on this modified golf cart that was all Mad Maxed out, and there were five of them. They jumped out and they had a board that had five shot glasses glued to it, and they poured five shots of whiskey and then made five of us line up in a row and then all do the shot at the same time. And then they got back on the thing and just roared off. And so it's just this random, it's a random acts of kindness kind of idea.
Kat, how do you feel physically and mentally at the end of Burning Man?
Oh, worn out. Worn out. And also very different. Very, like you've been home for a week. Very refreshing. But at the same time, coming home to the real world, it's nice to have a shower and a nap.
Yes. And Andy, would the world be a better place if it were all conducted like Burning Man? And could it be conducted like Burning Man?
I have a very strong feeling about it. Yes. Because information flows freely. People share. I'm talking about the ones that go with the Burning Man in their heart, which is pretty much our camp and the people we associate with. And life gets better. It's made me a better artist, too, by going there. People have shared their skills, and I share my skills.
And what about you, David?
That's a big question. I would hesitate to say yes or no, but it certainly has enriched my life immeasurably, and I come out of it feeling energized and just ready to tackle the next year.
Very good. Well, Burning Man starts in a couple of days. Our three guests are all going there in various capacities. David Watts Barton. This is his ninth year at Burning Man. He's an occasional host of Insight. He'll be hosting the program in September. He's also a blogger, Blogging the Grid. And we also were joined by Kat Deberg from the Pancake Playhouse, a Burning Man theme camp that serves pancakes, and Andy Pashalnikov. He's a photographer who's been photographing Burning Man since 2005, and he also takes part in a camp there. Thank you all very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And remember, some of Andy's photographs are at our webpage, capradio.org/insight, and a link to him where you can see more of them and not cropped. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. We'll go out with Burning Man Funk, a song by the Angels Camp band Klandyken, who were on our show yesterday and who are playing next week at Burning Man. Coming up, local novelist Brenda Novak on writing in the romance genre and why she raises hundreds of thousands of dollars for diabetes research. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can get a daily RSS feed telling you what's on the next edition of Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. Sacramento novelist Brandon Novak took an unusual path into writing. It involves a disturbing babysitter, but it's turned out pretty well for her. Novak is a successful author in the romance genre, romantic suspense to be more precise. This weekend in Sacramento, she's talking at a writer's workshop about the role of emotion in fiction. I spoke with Brenda Novak earlier this year around the time of her annual fundraising auction. Through it, she's raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for juvenile diabetes research. I asked her about her personal connection to the issue.
Yes, my son, who's now 11, was diagnosed when he was only 5 years old. And like most people, I was familiar with diabetes enough to know that he would require constant care. But what surprised me was, you know, when they start talking about some of the complications that could and sometimes do happen to diabetics. Diabetes is a disease that affects every major system in your body. And so as I was hearing these terrible things that could happen to my son, I was horrified. And I felt like because we're so familiar with diabetes, we've grown a bit complacent. And there are so many people suffering with this disease. I really feel like it's one of those hurdles we need to tackle and we need to get over, and I think we can definitely do it. So that's really what motivated me, is becoming more aware of the number of people that face these difficulties and having this personal connection to give me that burning motivation.
My guest is the author Brenda Novak. We're not expecting you to be an expert or an authority on diabetes, but just your understanding. What's the progress towards significant research on this?
There's some very exciting things happening. As a matter of fact, the National Diabetes Research Institute that's in Miami, at the University of Miami, they have recently transplanted islet cells into the eyes of mice and been able to cure diabetes in those mice. So obviously, you know, this is very exciting, because if we could somehow transfer what they've learned from these smaller animals and use it, you know, in humans, it would be fantastic. And the way they were able to achieve this is, I guess, the body's defense mechanism and the immune system doesn't kill the transplanted islet cells if they're in the eyes. So that offers hope that maybe we will be able to use some of this, you know, transplant procedure, whereas before, if you went the transplant route, you had to take these autoimmune suppressants, which could be as harmful and damaging as the disease. So it was, you know, sort of pick your poison at that point.
I'm sure your son is really pleased about the all the money you're raising for diabetes research, but I also know that for many kids it can be a little off-putting when your mom draws attention to you. How does he feel about the attention he's getting through your online auction?
Well, you know, fortunately my son is very he's not very self-conscious about having diabetes. He's not one of those. I know a lot of diabetics will, you know, want to hide their insulin pump. They don't really want to draw attention to it, and that's certainly understandable. I don't know if it's because he got it so young or it's just his particular personality, but he has no problem with it. He clips it out, you know, right where it's visible and moves on. And he's actually very excited about me getting involved in this. He'll come home from school and rush in to check, you know, how much are we at? He wants to hear the auction totals. And sometimes when I'm up working late, because it's, you know, quite a bit of work for one person to try and run a charity event of this magnitude, and he'll come up and put his little arms around me when he gets up in the night to go to the bathroom or something and say, oh, I love you, Mom. So I don't think that he has a problem with it. I think that would be difficult for me if I felt like it was causing him some embarrassment or some added attention that he wasn't enjoying. But fortunately, you know, for him, he seems to really let that kind of roll off him, and he's just all about making a difference and helping other people who have the same thing.
Brenda Novak is a Sacramento author who organizes an annual online auction to benefit diabetes research. Her new book, Trust Me, is set in Sacramento and published next month. You got started writing books through your life as a mother, right?
That's true. That was another sort of difficult situation I faced that actually caused me to do something that I was glad that I went in that direction. And what happened was I caught my daycare provider drugging my children with cough syrup and Tylenol to get them to sleep all day while I worked as a loan officer. And this was a person that came into my home and watched my children, and somebody that I trusted a great deal. She was a friend of the family besides, so she would come over, you know, in after hours and spend time with us. And so when I found this medicine in my baby's bottle, and it caused, you know, certain things to kind of click, like, oh, that's why they were all asleep when I got back from that bike ride, and it was an odd time of day for all three of them to be asleep. I only had three at the time. I have five now. And so I confronted her, and the truth came out. And it was just one of those things where I really felt like I felt so guilty about subjecting my children to this possibility even that I couldn't leave them to continue working outside the home. And so but at the same time, my husband is an entrepreneur, and he has, you know, done some incredible things with his businesses, but he's also had some tough spots, and the pendulum can swing very wide. And at this particular time, it was in 91, 92, and you might remember that in Sacramento, you know, the market, the real estate market really took a dive. And he had just chosen those years to branch out into residential real estate. So we had 30 homes in various stages of construction. And, in, you know, to his credit, they were pre-sold. They weren't spec homes. But our appraisals started coming in below our cost. And it was just a really bad financial time for us. And yet I felt like I couldn't go outside the home to work. So it forced me to, you know, get a little more resourceful, look at what assets I might have and how I could utilize those to do something at home. And
But writing books is a pretty speculative occupation in itself.
Yes, yes, it definitely is. And it's kind of crazy that I landed on it. The only asset I knew I possessed was that I was a really fast typist. So it was between, you know, writing a book or starting a typing service. And I decided that, you know, I was reading a good book and it really captured my imagination. And I thought, I think I can do this. And once I started, I realized, you know, that I had found my calling in life.
How did you decide what kind of books you would write?
Actually, it was kind of a business decision at first, believe it or not. I've always been a lover of the romance genre simply because I really like the happily ever after at the end. I like the conventions of the genre. But it's also 55% of all mass market paperback, which makes it the widest door into the publishing fortress, if you will. So it was sort of a mixture of both. I did enjoy the genre, but I was quite an eclectic reader. I by no means only read in that genre, and I preferred a lot of the classics to some of to what was being published. And so it was kind of a business decision. I wanted to make sure I had, you know, the greatest chance possible going into something that I knew would be difficult. And in all stories, no matter what genre they are, I enjoy them if there's a romantic relationship running through it.
Did you go out of your way to read a whole lot of romance novels to immerse yourself in the genre?
I did. I did some research that way and definitely, you know, grew to know what types of subgenres I like better. My favorite was historical. That's where I started. My first book was sold to HarperCollins, and it was called Of Noble Birth. But, you know, as you mentioned, this is a speculative venture, and I was orphaned, which means my editor was fired before that first book came out. And it basically means you've lost your advocate with that house, and you're starting over trying to submit and get somebody else interested in buying your work. And fortunately, I had sold a story at the same time, a contemporary story, to one of Harlequin's series lines. And that is what eventually grew into the career that I have now, because once I was orphaned at HarperCollins, I only had the contemporary leg to keep building.
You started this because you wanted to be able to earn money living at home. But as you become a successful and well-known author, doesn't that start pulling you out of the home?
It does. But fortunately, my children have grown older since I started this. And so my youngest is now 11. So he's the diabetic, but he's also very savvy and able to, you know, take care of himself when mom has to be away. But I don't travel all that much. I will do some traveling and speaking, maybe 3 conventions a year. But other than that, you know, I'm working in my office at home where he can always come in. I'm always available to him and they, you know, any of my children, and they can speak to me.
Your next book, which is just about to be published, is called Trust Me, and it's set in Sacramento. Why is it set in Sacramento?
I love this area. You know, I've lived here now for over 20 years, and I also wanted, because this is a series, I was building an entire series. 3 books will come out this summer, 3 books will come out next summer, and so I thought for research purposes, it was somewhat of a practical decision as well. For research purposes, I wanted everything that I needed as far as police procedural information. I wanted it all very close to home. And I also think that there are some wonderful places that you can really highlight in these books, like the Delta is the setting for the first book, Trust Me. The heroine lives in the Delta, and so, you know, those small, interesting towns that they have out there, it was fun to go out and visit and do some research on that.
Are any of the characters in your book based on recognizable people in Sacramento?
No, actually, they're all fictional. I mean, you may recognize certain traits from people that I come in contact with, but I by no means put, you know, the people that I know in my books, just you can highlight certain traits. And my husband would probably be the only one to recognize it, and he would smile and say, oh, you got that from so-and-so or such-and-such an event.
In addition to all of this, you cycle 20 miles a day?
Yes, well, only Monday through Friday. I take the weekends off.
Slacker. 20 miles a day, that's quite a bit.
Yes, yes. It's something that you must do if you're going to be sitting in a chair the other hours of the day, though. You need to do something to really enhance your creativity and keep yourself from getting overweight. And I really feel like staying fit has added a whole new dimension to my life. I really do enjoy the outdoors, and I like being able to hang with the kids when they, you know, go running or biking or whatever it is they want to do.
And where do you cycle, the American River?
Yes, American River Bike Trail, although I have to admit that a lot of those miles now are on my stationary bike because I can also critique and, you know, kill two birds with one stone, to borrow a cliche, and, you know, get some work done at the same time.
Wow. Very good. Well, that's Brenda Novak, Sacramento author. She organizes an annual online auction to benefit diabetes research, and her new book, Trust Me, is set in Sacramento, and it's just published. You can find out more information about Brenda at our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Brenda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was very fun.
Romance novelist Brenda Novak on Insight in May. She's speaking at a writer's workshop this weekend, tomorrow actually, organized by Sacramento Valley Rose, a local chapter of Romance Writers of America. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, how Dan Hicks really feels about his most famous song, How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away? We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight interns get real responsibility and training. Find out more on the careers page at capradio.org. Musician Dan Hicks takes his lighthearted, swinging country blues to Penn Valley this Saturday with his band, The Hot Licks. He's been playing in bands of various kinds since the mid-50s, and yet released one of his most acclaimed albums just 4 years ago, Selected Shorts, which featured guest turns by musicians like Jimmy Buffett and Willie Nelson. I spoke with Dan Hicks late last year, and we'll listen to some of that conversation in a minute. But first, from Selected Shorts, here's Barstool Boogie.
I wish I was crazy tonight.
You're already crazy.
As crazy as I was that night.
And a little
when
lazy.
The beat got a little too right.
Everybody bought
and nobody
it.
Could sit tight.
They were table
when
hopping.
The dance floor was too full.
It was a little
when
crowded.
The band played a Don't Be Cruel.
And they started
yeah,
jumping.
The place got a little unreal.
Rocking and jamming.
Cause nobody could sit still.
Rocking and slamming.
There wasn't any room to dance.
They got the heebie-jeebies.
So they sat right there and danced.
Dan Hicks, welcome to Insight.
Hey, you're not going to let the song finish?
Well, no, we don't have time.
That's okay. I didn't want to listen. I didn't want to hear it anyway. I've been there, done that. Yeah, good to be on the old airwaves here in the Sacramento area in big preparation for my big, fantastic extravaganza with a cast of virtually, there's almost 10 of us.
Almost 10 of you.
Yeah, there's six.
Now, tell us about Barstool Boogie. You did that duet with Jimmy Buffett. Are you a friend of Jimmy Buffett, or did you just think, you know, that's a guy I'd like to work with on this song?
Well, it's more of the latter. I have met Jimmy Buffett, and we of course were kind of. I think we were ships in the night passing back in the 70s and stuff. He did come to see a show about 4 or 5 years ago down in Florida where he lives, and he was backstage and seemed like a really, really nice guy. I liked him. So when he actually said something like, I didn't realize how much I stole from you when he saw my act. So to speak, you know. So anyway, yeah. So the idea was to get a few guests for that album, Selected Shorts, and I felt around to see who was available and who might be interested, and Jimmy Buffett's name came up, and contacted him, and actually his part of it was put on later via the modern electronics, you know, these days. And I wasn't even in the studio with him. But that's been done before. We talked on the phone, and we talked about it, and I sent him, like, I sent him my idea of when he should sing and stuff like that. And it was kind of a party tune, I guess, so he sort of fit in there.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so that was how that kind of came about.
My guest is Dan Hicks. You describe your kind of music as folk jazz. How did you come up with the idea to fuse those two kinds of music?
Well, actually, the phrase I use myself is folk swing, more of a swing, so okay. that it gets a little more descriptive. Swing and jazz and everything is my first love in music, way back to grade school, actually, or at least junior high. And then I kind of took up the folk guitar and everything when the folk boom came in the early 60s. That became my favorite music, so I sort of combined my two favorite listening experiences and somewhat playing, too. I'd been playing drums and everything, playing some jazz.
Yeah.
So I had the two things of being what I liked, and I kind of hopefully kind of combined them a little bit.
Let's go back to your first album in 1969, Original Recordings, and some of your best-known songs are on that album. Let's listen to a bit of one of them. It's How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away.
Okay.
To your mother and I've talked to your dad. They say they've tried, but it's all in vain. I've begged and I've pleaded, I've even got mad. Now we must face it, you give me a pain. How can I miss you when you won't go away? Keep telling you day after day, but you won't listen, you always stay and stay. How can I miss you when you won't go away?
What kind of music did you grow up with? I know you were born in Arkansas, but your family moved to California when you were pretty young.
Yeah, I guess I was around five by the time we got to California. My dad was in the military, and I'd lived in the Midwest and a little bit in the East Coast. And so, I became an official Californian when I got into kindergarten out here. So what kind of music did we listen to? Did I listen to? Well, they were country western fans, it seems to me. That was what was on the radio. And sort of that kind of 50s corny pop stuff my mother liked, too. You know, Lawrence Welk and Ferrante and Teicher and, How Much Is That Doggy in the Window and stuff. They they liked all that stuff, too, and a lot of country stuff. And so that's sort of, I guess, what I heard. I went to a few country shows in around Napa and Vallejo and stuff. Saw a few live acts in those days.
What's it like for you nowadays playing songs like How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away and other famous songs by you after all these decades? Do you still enjoy it?
Well, that particular one I'm getting a little tired of. I think, you know, every now and then I make a list of songs we're doing. And I don't even think I put that one on the list.
Really?
There's a list. Yeah, but we still do it. I'll still do it. I'll go into it when I think it's like the song to do right now or something. Or if I don't know, somebody from the crowd is yelling it out and won't quit.
Well, it's one of the all-time great titles, though.
So, well, thanks. Yeah. I'll do, but most of the songs I do that are from back a ways are the ones I like to do, like Scare Myself and Canned Music and some of those. I mean, I do the ones I still like to do, actually. So it's not like I feel like none of them I have to do or anything like that, except maybe when we get to How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away? There's a tune called O'Reilly at the Bar. The theme is I'm Gonna Smash Your Face, you know, sort of a Irish ditty. And it gets a lot of requests, but that could be my number one song, least likely to want to do.
Mm.
So there are those. I do have like a rating system, I guess.
Well, you mentioned I Scare Myself. Let's listen to a clip of that.
Okay.
I scare myself, and I don't mean lightly. I scare myself, it can get frightening. I scare myself to think what I could do. I scare myself,
is some kind of voodoo. And with that voodoo, I keep thinking of you.
Now, that song, of course, was also covered by Thomas Dolby. It was a much more sinister version of the song. What did you think of that version of your song?
You know, I always, my experience has been, I've had a few people record my tunes, and I always like it, and I always feel that it's flattering, and I always dig it, and that fits into with Thomas's version too. I liked it; got that trombone solo and everything, and it was also an MTV on some kind of rotation on MTV, so there was a video, and there was some dancing, and it was kind of neat, and it was flattering, and. Mm-hmm. I like the whole experience, you know. I really, really always do when people record my stuff. I'm not like Paul Williams or somebody that has like everybody record their songs all the time. So it's kind of a total kick for me. Tuck and Patty did a song of mine. Bill Wyman, bass player, and the Stones did a tune, and. Of course, Maria Muldaur, Sleep at the Wheel, and, you know, there's been some...
Pay some mortgage.
some instances there.
Yeah. Now, I've read in a couple of places that Thomas Dolby appears on the album Selected Shorts, but I can't confirm that. I thought we should go to the source.
I can't confirm that either.
You can't.
I cannot confirm that. So, I'm pretty much, you know, you're talking about this show as Inside...
Yes.
Yeah, well, I'm on the inside of making those albums. And, yeah, no, I really can't confirm that either. So
okay, well.
Maybe somebody can come along and confirm that. But we've never been on anything together. I did a thing with him at the BAMMYs, and you know, one year here in San Francisco,
Bay Area Music Awards.
Yeah. I guess they're still going. I'm not real sure, but it was, you know, that magazine and everything. Bam, yeah. And we got up on the stage together and gave away some award. But that's been about it.
We've got time to listen to one more clip, and this this is also from Selected Shorts. The song, First I Lost My Marbles.
Oh, good.
First I lost my marbles, and then I lost you.
Lost my marbles.
It's been a rocky road, I don't know what to do. I thought you'd always stand by me through thick and thin. There's no one standing here, I'd better think again. Is it the blues I've got, or am I just a fool? Or has my mind forgot how to have a clue? And when they lock me up, that's when I'll finally be free of all these troubles and insanity.
Is that a sequel to How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away?
Well, you know, it is sort of another love, twisted love song. This guy, the guy in this tune, is, no, he wants the girl. The other, the How Can I Miss You guy doesn't want her anymore.
Yeah.
But this guy here is like a sick puppy dog, you know, and he's so I don't know, obsessed that they're going to lock him up. They're going to put him in a padded cell because he's so wigged out.
When people go see you play, they see you for the most part singing and playing the guitar, but you started out as a drummer. Do you drum much now?
Oh, you know, I still have a drum set, and I'll sit down occasionally if I'm I don't know, sitting in or something, or but I don't really you know, practice or anything. I play a little bit of rhythm sometime in the band, a little brush stuff with the Hot Licks, and so yeah, I like it still, and I dabble.
Very good.
Yeah.
And I've been saying it's Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks, but of course the Lickettes are coming too.
Yeah, you know, the Lickettes, kind of that name kind of just came about just by I don't know what evolution.
These are the backing singers for people who don't
know. Yeah, they're the two girls that sing with me, and then I introduced them, the Lickettes, and then I introduced the guys. I've been doing this lately as the Lickmen. So, so, and then I guess the whole thing put together, including me, is the Hot Licks. You know? So, it was just the Lick Cats, you know.
Yeah.
And they played some percussion, and we danced a little bit, and of course, there's all the vocal.
Dan Hicks, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, well, thanks for letting me spout a little bit. Well, thanks for having me on.
Musician Dan Hicks speaking on Insight last December. He and his band, The Hot Licks, play Penn Valley tomorrow. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about our guests and topics, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producer was Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The assistant producer, Robin Souza. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. And thank you for joining us.